Madame, Monsieur, good evening. I'm Robert Leckie. I have the great privilege of being Dean of the McGill Faculty of Law, and I'm thrilled to welcome you to this evening's Wallenberg Lecture. I'm not surprised it's a full house, but it's always a signal when a lecture, when a topic, when the person speaking, when the unit within the faculty connects deeply to the wider community. You sense it when the Maxwell Cohen Moot Court is filled to the gills. The Faculty of Law, as many of you know, is a vibrant site of encounter, of discussion, where challenging debates take place, where students learn and professors learn from one another every single day. But the endowed lectureships housed in the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism represent really some of the highest moments in the life of the faculty over the academic year. And I remember from my student days a long line of distinguished, inspiring speakers. Now, by November, there are probably some first-year students in the room, and I'm aware that by November, they can start to bog down a little bit. They're working very hard to have their consideration and their duty of care lined up. Exams are starting to appear on the horizon. But an event like tonight, with our extraordinary guest speaker, will remind them where the passion is that brought them into the Faculty of Law. We'll remind them to look beyond the dark days of November and the technical things of law, and to remember ideas and commitment and people making a difference about things they believe in deeply. I want to salute the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism and the important role that it plays in the life of the Faculty of Law, in opening us up to the world, sending our students around the planet for transformative experiences for themselves and for others, and bringing the world here. Just a few hours ago, I was speaking to one of the center's donors about the exceptional impact of the programming of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism. Things accomplished with a dedicated but very small team and the most modest of resources. And I want to salute as well the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism's spirit of collaboration working tonight with the Raoul Wallenberg Center. Je vais ensuite passer la parole au directeur du centre, M. François Crépeau, qui est titulaire de la chaire Oppenheimer. François.
Ladies and gentlemen, as Robert has said, my name is François Crépeau. I'm the director of the McGill Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism. Welcome to the 2017 Wallenberg Lecture. Allow me to introduce the center and its activities to show you how this lecture tonight takes place in a very rich intellectual environment. Since its inception in 2005, the McGill Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism has become the locus of interdisciplinary initiatives and scholarship on human rights issues, with 32 full members and 7 associate members coming from several disciplines, as well as from all of Montreal universities. We form a powerful research community covering many human rights issues, from gender equity to refugee policies, from resource-based conflicts to humanitarian operations, from Aboriginal issues to child soldiers, from environmental rights to systemic discrimination, from persons with disabilities to labor exploitation. Every year, we can count on the dynamism, energy, and imagination of dozens of students, both undergraduate and graduate. For them and with them, we manage, for example, a very successful program of paid international human rights internships, which has seen 27 students go to the four corners of the world last summer. We also manage a number of clerkships in international tribunals. We organize numerous conferences, seminars, lectures, brown bags every year on many topics. We have, for example, a disability seminar series, which is very popular. We also have developed a number of recorded dialogues on human rights and legal pluralism issues, the videos of which can be consulted on the website. Our O'Brien and Steinberg fellowship programs provide scholarships to graduate students from all over the world. Our O'Brien Fellows in Residence program allows many human rights actors and activists to spend between a month and half a year within our walls, creating an extraordinary synergy between students, academics, and practitioners of human rights. We have thus received, just by way of example, a judge from the South African Constitutional Court, a public defender from New York, a former UN official who dedicated his life to poverty reduction, etc. Over the years, the center has also been responsible for steering a number of named lectureships, including the Cassin Lecture, the Humphrey Lecture, the Litvak Prize and Lecture, and, as is the case tonight, the Wallenberg Lecture. These lectures continue the legacy of our faculty's tradition of public engagement with human rights issues. For the past 12 years, my predecessors, Professor René Provost and Professor Colleen Shepherd, as well as my colleague, Professor Nandini Ramanujam, and myself, have endeavored to shape such lectureships in order to have them address the most important, pressing, and innovative human rights challenges facing our global community. The Wallenberg Lecture Series was inaugurated in 1988, almost 30 years ago, when Professor Erwin Kotler invited Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel to address our community in this same room. And several other prestigious speakers have done us the honor of accepting to give the Wallenberg Lecture over the years. Among our impressive range of members, I would like now to invite Professor Emeritus Erwin Kotler, who was my professor a few decades ago and is an esteemed member of our center, to introduce our guest speaker for tonight, the Honorable Justice Rosalia Bella. Erwin.
Thank you, Francois. As it happened, it's not as important that I taught Francois as that his father taught me. So you see the intergenerational connection, and I'm delighted that the Raoul Wallenberg Center has the opportunity to partner together with the McGill Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism on a number of activities, and in particular with regard to the lectureship this evening. And where it is my privilege and pleasure to introduce Justice Rosalia Bella to you. As you know, the Raoul Wallenberg Lectureship in Human Rights was established in memory of and in tribute to the Swedish diplomat Raoul Wallenberg, who demonstrated how one person with the compassion to care and the courage to act can confront evil, prevail, and thereby transform history. Francois reminded me that it may not be that we all remember what Raoul Wallenberg did. So just one example. From the end of May to the beginning of July 1944, 440,000 Hungarian Jews were deported to the death camps in Auschwitz, while the bystander community stood by. Raoul Wallenberg arrived as a Swedish diplomat in a Swedish legation in Budapest in the summer of 1944, and together with others whom he mobilized in his rescue mission, then saved the remnant of 100,000 Jews. So what an international bystander community did not do, one person in the company of others whom he inspired was, as I said, able to confront evil and thereby transform history. The inaugural Raoul Wallenberg Lectureship, as Francois mentioned, was inaugurated here in McGill by Nobel Peace Laureate Elie Wiesel at a Nuremberg conference. And as it happened, 18 months ago, Justice Abella was the keynote speaker at a conference on the double entendre of Nuremberg, the double meaning of Nuremberg, the Nuremberg of hate and the Nuremberg of judgments, which took place at Jagiellonian University in Poland. Justice Abella is herself a daughter of Holocaust survivors. Her father was a graduate of Jagiellonian University in Poland, and on the occasion of the conference, she received then a copy of his graduation certificate. And she then gave the keynote speech at that memorable conference, which, as it happened, was the last public act. Elie Wiesel was the honorary chair of the conference, and that turned out to be his last public act before his passing. Indeed, apart from being the honorary chair of the Raoul Wallenberg Center for Human Rights, Justice Abella has had an ongoing relationship with McGill faculty and students, which has included being a visiting Bolton professor here over the years, delivering the McGill Law Journal Lecture, the F.R. Scott Lecture, inaugurating the Phyllis Shapiro Lecture, and many other occasions where faculty and students have had the opportunity, the pleasure, and the privilege to interact with her. Justice Abella was the youngest judge ever appointed a judge in Canada when, in 1976, at the age of 29, she was appointed to the Ontario Family Court. She then was appointed to the Ontario Court of Appeal by the Mulroney government in 1992 and to the Supreme Court in 2004 by the Martin government, thereby reflecting the bipartisan respect in which her excellence, experience, and empathy were held as they all characterized her respectively at the time. In 1984, as some of us may remember, she was the sole commissioner of the Royal Commission on Equality in Employment, wherein she coined not only the term employment equity, but began to spawn the scholarship and jurisprudence in equality rights, which has marked not only Canadian, but international jurisprudence as well. Among her many distinguished international awards, Justice Abella, and this is astonishing, has been the recipient of 37 honorary doctorates from different universities around the globe. And indeed, in the last 18 months alone, she became the first woman from Canada ever to earn an honorary doctorate from Yale University, indeed only the fourth Canadian ever to do so, was named a barrister of the Middle Temple of the United Kingdom by the unanimous vote of the UK Parliament, which is probably the only unanimous vote that they've held on anything in this regard, and recently became the recipient of the Ethical Leadership Award from Dalhousie University. And may I close by citing the words from the Yale citation on the occasion of her receiving an honorary doctorate, because I think it sums it up best and offers expert witness testimony in this regard. The citation said that she was selected as one of the world's, as being one of the world's finest jurors, and then went on to say, "You defend human rights and justice in your home nation of Canada and around the globe. You approach your work with zest, empathy, and superb intelligence. The child of Holocaust survivors born in Europe in a camp for displaced persons, you know firsthand the terrors of oppression and inhumanity." And then concluded, "Your pioneering judgments have extended the protection of law to all. You are a champion of the vulnerable and inspiration to everyone. You know that indifference is injustice's incubator. We are proud of your service to Yale and honored to name you a Doctor of Laws, and we are honored to have you here this evening as our Raoul Wallenberg lecturer."
What's this? I can't see my husband. Oh, there you are. Well, now you know why I accepted the invitation to speak tonight, because Irwin said he would introduce me. And if any of you in this room have never been introduced by Irwin Kotler, I can tell you that that's all you need to make you feel your life has been worthwhile. So, Irwin, what can I say? It's a joyful friendship. It's so easy to love what you do for all of us. You and Ariella are people we cherish, And thank you for launching me tonight as generously as you did. I think you all know, and if you don't, you should, that I'm not the only person who loves Irwin. He just got an honorary degree from the University of Montreal last week, and I think we should applaud that. So, Dean Leckie, Professor Crapo, I knew your father, too. Actually, this room is full of very old friends, some former students, some former colleagues, lots of friends from lots of places, and I think some of them may even be old enough to remember that I wore this bar mitzvah dress 28 years ago. But Irwin, every once in a while, our profession makes an iconic contribution to the country. And every once in a while, our profession even makes an iconic contribution to the world. And because of Irwin Cotler, we have both an enhanced country and an enhanced world. He's committed to promoting the role of law, the rule of law, the compassion of law, and the fairness of law. And above all, he's insistent on ensuring that law and justice never leave each other's side as they patrol the universe. And all this combines with a magic alchemy of enthusiasm, optimism, generosity, wisdom, humility, and preternatural tenacity to make each of us better, Canada better, and the world better. So this lecture is dedicated not only to Raoul Wallenberg, but to his spiritual heir, Irwin Cotler. Which means it's a lecture about human rights, which means it's a lecture about justice. Some of what I say will be familiar to you, but that's because in a way that's hard to explain. So much of what I've thought about, written about, and worried about over the years all seem to coalesce around Wallenberg and what he represented. And because this is a lecture in honor, too, of Irwin, it will be a lecture in several parts. I've spent my adult life steeped in the textures of justice, and despite my ongoing infatuation with literature, music, movies, and theater, not to mention grandchildren, justice is still what my brain spends most of its time fixated on. And that's why what I'd like to share with you tonight is what I see as the state of justice, nationally and internationally. In other words, let's see whether, to paraphrase Martin Luther King, the long arc of the moral universe has bent towards justice. Let me set the moral stage with a morality play set in the Second World War. It's Michael Frayn's brilliant play, Copenhagen. In his play, justice plays out through a fictionalized account of what happened at a real meeting in Copenhagen in September 1941 between two Nobel laureates, Niels Bohr and his former student, the German physicist, Werner Heisenberg. The meeting took place in Bohr's home. Together, the two men had revolutionized atomic physics in the 20s with their work on quantum mechanics and the uncertainty principle. I remember at the time, sitting in the theater, turning to my husband, because I didn't understand a word of what was happening, and said, "Couldn't you get tickets to My Fair Lady?" But I was intrigued, and I bought the play, and I read it, and it's extraordinary. The moral question at the heart of the play is what Heisenberg's duty was as a loyal German and as a scientist in charge of its nuclear program. Was he obliged to help protect Germany by developing the atomic bomb? Or was he obliged to protect the world from Germany by sabotaging its production? The atom bomb was never developed in Germany, as you know, and the play leaves unclear whether this was due to Heisenberg's deliberate derailment of the German atomic project or as a result of just getting the calculations wrong. The genius of the play is the way it plays on the tensions between the mentor, Niels Bohr, half-Jewish and living self-consciously and proudly in occupied Denmark, developing nuclear expertise for the Allies, and the acolyte, Werner Heisenberg, working conscientiously and proudly for the occupier and the honor of German science. Both scientists blamed themselves and each other for perceived breaches of their moral responsibilities as scientists. Bohr for going to America, where he worked at Los Alamos and played what he called his small but helpful part in the deaths of 100,000 people at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Heisenberg for working for a crazed dictator. I found the most interesting speech in the play to be Heisenberg's explanation for his ambivalence when he says, "We have one set of obligations to the world in general, and we have other sets, never to be reconciled, to our fellow countrymen, to our neighbors, to our friends, to our family, to our children. All we can do is look afterwards and see what happened." The point of the play isn't what actually happened at the meeting between Bohr and Heisenberg, because no one really knows, but about what it tells us about how we make moral choices and how the context of the moment may not be a sufficient defense in history's court. So let's look afterwards and see what moral choices Canada and the world made in my lifetime to see how the arc of the moral universe bent, first in Canada. When I was born in 1946, I know I don't look it, right? Sometimes I do. The final adjudicative body for Canadian cases was still the Privy Council in England. By the time I graduated from law school in 1970, the Supreme Court had already begun to clear pioneering paths. By the time I became a judge on the Supreme Court of Canada in 2004, it was in full flight. What happened to Canadian justice in between was nothing short of revolutionary. Legislatures across the country, encouraged by a public newly sensitized the previous decade to the inhibiting power of tradition, shone roving flashlights across their social landscapes. They exposed the inequities both created and hidden by the law's Pavlovian obedience to the neutrality of its own indifference, and responded with a seismic reformulation of what constitutes the Canadian mainstream and who gets to join it. From 1970, with the report on the Royal Commission on the Status of Women, the document that provided the ramp from the dislocating agitation of the 60s to the reconfigurating policies of the 70s, we launched a new journey in this country, which was, if not always about law, always about justice. Nous avons instauré le bilinguisme and multiculturalism, gave persons with disabilities protected status in human rights codes, entered into serious dialogue with Indigenous people, welcomed waves of non-white immigrants, abolished the matrimonial property regimes that for centuries had kept wives on an economic continuum that ranged from invisible to inconsolable, and watched women ponder competing visions of security as they made the transition to a world with options. And then, with the majestic Charter of Rights and Freedoms 35 years ago, our justice journey became a justice juggernaut. We constitutionalized the protection of rights, gave independent judges the authority to enforce them, and introduced the public to a new Canadian justice narrative that rendered the status quo vulnerable to heightened expectations. It was, as a result, sometimes a controversial vision, and in some ways, it still is. But out of the ashes of controversy emerged the phoenix of awareness, public awareness of who the judiciary was and what it did, and judicial awareness of who the public was and why what it thinks matters. La magistrature et le public continuent d'apprendre à mieux se connaître, mais la vision que je viens d'évoquer demeure un phare dont la lumière continue de guider et d'éclairer nos actions. We strengthened our democracy by enhancing and guaranteeing its constituent rights and freedoms, and we enhanced our country by strengthening and guaranteeing its democratic values. And where are we now in the year of Canada's 150th birthday? Now, we are the world's largest justice exporter, with our legislatures passing laws and our courts rendering decisions that are emulated all through the Western world. We've gone from being respectfully and deferentially colonial to being singularly and spectacularly independent. Having had the benefit of watching more mature democracies work their way through the conceptual challenges of modern governance. We thank them for their example and proceeded to carve out our own unique and magnetically illuminating vision, one that started where other countries had left off, and then we soared into new territory. And how gloriously we soared, parting company with the past and developing a robust justice consensus that is the envy of the world. Where for others, pluralism and diversity are fragmenting magnets, for us, they're unifying. Where for others, assimilation is a social goal, for us, it represents the inequitable obliteration of the identities that define us. Where for others, treating everyone the same is the dominant governing principle. For us, it takes its place alongside the principle that treating everyone the same can result in ignoring the differences that need to be respected if we're to be truly inclusive. Integration based on difference, equality based on inclusion despite difference, and compassion based on respect and fairness. These are the principles that, to me, form the moral core of our national values, the values that make us the most successful practitioners of multiculturalism in the world, and the values whose integrity require our vigilant protection. We have, however, lots of work left to do. We're far from resolving the consequences of our frequently shameful and misguided treatment of Indigenous people. We have yet to figure out how to fix the unconscionable social, economic, political, and psychological disequilibrium created by poverty. Access to justice is still inaccessible for most people. There are existing and pending literacy issues that may impair our ability to reach out and explain policy options to the voting public. With each new technological advance comes advancing threats to our ability to protect our privacy. And there are still too many members of racial and religious minorities waiting for the rhetoric of equality to materialize into their reality. But the overall transformation of Canada from a country that had excluded those who were different into one that embraced them is, to me, justice at its best. Accompanied by a free press, an independent bench and bar, the right to dissent, and accountable government, justice at its aspirational best continues to guide Canada and ensures not only our democratic vibrancy, but also a secure moral foundation and compass. Let's take a few minutes to explore the philosophical roots of Canada's approach to human rights, not by comparing Aristotle to Dworkin, but by using literary metaphors. I've always seen justice as the application of law to life. And since my own life experiences have been happy and limited, I've always found literature to be a helpful tutor in understanding the world from other people's perspective. Ralph Ellison, the author of the remarkable 1952 novel, The Invisible Man, said in the preface to that book that for him, a novel could be fashioned as a raft of hope, perception, and entertainment that might help keep us afloat as we try to negotiate the snags and whirlpools that mark our nation's vacillating course toward and away from the democratic ideal. So let's see how some of these rafts of perception can help us negotiate and understand the democratic ideal of equality. The American approach is called the melting pot and was first identified as such in a 1909 play by Israel Zangwill, a British author who was the child of immigrants from Russia and grew up in the Jewish ghetto in London in the second half of the 19th century. Like many, he struggled with the paradoxically simultaneous commitment to his Jewish values as he learned them in the ghetto and an attraction to the world beyond its restrictions. His play, called The Melting Pot, has the irresistible charm of a period piece and the appeal of ingenuous optimism. The story is about a Jewish musician and composer who has recently come to America after losing most of his family in a Russian pogrom. He is irrepressibly optimistic about America, as he explains to his Russian non-Jewish woman with whom he eventually falls in love. David's uncle is astonished by David's relationship with a non-Jewish woman. But for David, quote, America is God's crucible, the great melting pot where all races of Europe are melting and reforming, fused into real Americans. So one's origins, according to Zangwill, seem to be nothing more than fuel for the fires that fused the differences into a new identity, American. In two prescient articles in The Nation in 1915, Horace Kalin incisively challenged the melting pot theory. He urged as an alternative to the melting pot theory an appreciation that not all differences can or should be eradicated in the national interest. Behind and in every immigrant, he noted, were his or her ancestors and, quote, whatever else we change, we cannot change our grandfathers, quote. Almost 50 years later, we find the debate being played out between a young black idealist at the center of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, a grandchild of slaves, who experiences indignity, humiliation, and bewilderment on his trek from a black college in the South to New York's Harlem. One of his black mentors in Harlem is shocked to see that the black hero, whose name is never named in the book, keeps on his desk a leg link worn by a black friend who for 19 years had been on a chain gang. The older black says, I don't think we ought to dramatize our differences. I'm not dramatizing anything. I think it's a good reminder of what our movement is fighting against. That's the worst kind of thing for brotherhood. We want to make folks think of the things we have in common. That's what makes for brotherhood. We have to change this way we have of always talking about how different we are. In the brotherhood, we're all brothers. And later that same decade, we have an eerily similar exchange in Philip Roth's short story, Defender of the Faith, in his book, Goodbye Columbus, where an exasperated Jewish sergeant asks the demanding Jewish soldier who was the cause of his exasperation, Grossbart, why can't you be like the rest of us? Why do you have to stick out like a sore thumb? Because I'm a Jew, Sergeant. I am different. Maybe not better, but different. This is a war, Grossbart. For the time being, be the same. I refuse. What? I refuse. I can't stop being me. That's all there is to it. Remarkable, too, is a similarity in how these writers revel in those rare situations in which they find to their surprise that theirs is the dominant identity. Here is the black hero in Invisible Man, arriving in Harlem from the segregated American South, seeing himself for the first time as part of the majority. He says, at the intersection, I had the shock of seeing a black policeman directing traffic, and there were white drivers in the traffic who obeyed his signals as though it was the most natural thing in the world. My courage returned. And here is Philip Roth's marveling in 1993 in Operation Shylock at being in an Israeli courtroom in a country where he was now part of the majority and seeing justice administered by Jews. Jewish judges, Jewish laws, Jewish flags, and non-Jewish defendants. Courtrooms such as Jews had envisioned in their fantasies for many hundreds of years. Isn't it ironic that these two writers, separated by experience, color, religion, use law and justice as their metaphor for expressing wonder on learning that someone with their identity can simultaneously retain that identity and be in the mainstream? There's a shared longing to belong, a shared longing for justice, and for the right in the name of justice to bring into the mainstream those different identities that had kept them out. There is, in short, a shared longing to belong, assimilation if necessary, but not necessarily assimilation. And what in the end are in these writers' voices? Their pleas for integration, for a social unity based on diversity and on uniqueness, for respect based on difference, and for self-respect based on identity. Please, in short, for equality, the essence of human rights. Let's take a moment to think about whether that's different from civil liberties, the other set of rights. Well, to answer that question, we have to start with the rampant religious, feudal, and monarchical repression in the 17th century in France and England, which inspired new political philosophies protecting individuals from having their freedoms interfered with by governments. These were the theories of civil liberties which came to dominate the rights discussion for the next 300 years. They were also the theories which journeyed across the Atlantic Ocean and found themselves planted firmly in American soil, receiving confirmation in the Declaration of Independence, guaranteeing that every man enjoyed the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that government existed only to bring about the best conditions for the preservation of those rights. And thus was born the essence of civil liberties, the belief that every American had the same right as every other American to be free from government intervention. To be equal was to have this same right, no differences, and the less government, the better. But unlike the United States, we in Canada were never concerned only with the rights of individuals. Our historical roots involved as well a constitutional appreciation that the two groups at the constitutional bargaining table, the French and the English, could and should remain distinct and unassimilated, and on that basis, to be considered equal. That is, unlike the United States, whose individualism promoted assimilation, we in Canada have always appreciated that the right to integrate based on differences has as much legal and political integrity as the right to assimilate. And that approach, our respect for differences, is why Canada, in my view, is the most successful practitioner of multiculturalism in the world. In any event, the individualism at the core of the political philosophy of rights articulated in the American Constitution became America's most significant international export and the exclusive rights barometer for countries in the Western world. Concern for the rights of the individual monopolized through medial endeavors of pursuers of justice all over the world. It wasn't until 1945 that we came to realize that having chained ourselves to the pedestal of the individual, we had been ignoring rights abuses of a fundamentally different kind, namely, the rights of individuals in groups to retain their different identities without fear of the loss of life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness. It was World War II which jolted us permanently from our complacent belief that the only way to protect rights was to keep government at a distance and protect each individual individually. And what jolted us was the horrifying spectacle of group destruction, a spectacle so far removed from what we thought were the limits of rights violations in civilized societies that we found our entire vocabulary and remedial arsenal inadequate. We were left with no moral alternative but to acknowledge that individuals could be denied rights not in spite of, but because of their differences, and started to formulate ways to protect the rights of the group in addition to those of the individual. We had, in short, come to see the brutal role of discrimination, and we invented the term human rights to confront it. We gave governments the authority to devise remedies to prevent arbitrary harm based on identities of race or religion or gender or ethnicity. And we respected government's new right to treat us differently to redress abuses our differences had attracted. So we blasted away at the conceptual wall that had kept us from understanding the inhibiting role group differences played and extended the prospect of full socioeconomic participation to women, non-whites, indigenous people, persons with disabilities, and those with different linguistic and sexual preferences. And most significantly, we offered this full participation and accommodation based on and notwithstanding group differences. Civil liberties had given us the universal right to be equally free from an intrusive state regardless of group identity. Human rights gave us the universal right to be equally free from discrimination based on group identity. We need both. And Canada has figured that out, that if we want to include the widest possible number of individuals, we must appreciate that they were excluded not simply as the individuals equally free to pursue legally sanctioned objectives, but as individuals whose group affiliation often created arbitrary barriers to access and outcome. Equality, as we've defined it in Canada since the first equality case decided by the Supreme Court of Canada in Andrews, is the remedy for this exclusion. It argues that there's a difference between social evolution and social Darwinism. One accommodates, the other neglects. One narrows the gap, the other tolerates it. Narrowing the gap means narrowing the possibility of discrimination, and that, I think, is at the heart of Canada's approach to human rights. And this brings me to the next part of my lecture. Gesundheit, the approach to human rights in the rest of the world, where the gap seems to be widening. As I told you, I was born in 1946, the year justice emerged assertively from the injustices of World War II. We had watched in horror as all our assumptions about shared global values of respect, dignity, and tolerance turned out not to be shared after all, and engaged in global combat to restore their primacy. We won, and we created the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the Genocide Convention, all to preserve the conceptual fruits of victory. And we vindicated those primal values at Nuremberg, where we showed the world not only that justice was the motivational core of our global rehabilitation, it was, as the incarnation of human rights, an implementable one. But I am no longer convinced that the moral consensus I grew up with is safe in the rest of the world. Too many rights abuses go unrecognized, let alone confronted. Too many governments have interfered with the independence of their media and their judges. Too many people have lost their liberty arbitrarily. Too many people are hungry. Too many people have died in armed conflicts. And too many people have lost hope. This was not supposed to happen. No one expected injustice to disappear, but the global compass was supposed to stay pointed in the direction of its reduction. Instead, we're in danger of a new status quo, one where intolerance is tolerated and tolerance is not. That means we're in danger of a new status quo that is, tragically, too much like the old one we fought a world war to fix. Since the UN was established in 1946, the world has seen the most sophisticated development of international laws, treaties, and conventions the international community has ever known, all stating that human rights abuses will not be tolerated, from the Declaration of Human Rights to the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and from the Conventions Against Racial Discrimination and Discrimination Against Women to the Convention Against Torture. But the human rights revolution that started with the UN after and because of World War II seems to have too few disciples in the countries that need it most. In the face of these hundreds of protective laws, since 1946, over 40 million people have died as a result of conflicts in the world. We've had genocides in Rwanda and Cambodia, massacres in Bosnia, Congo, and Darfur, repression in Chechnya and Myanmar, and of course, slaughter in Syria, among many, many others. These human rights abuses are putting the rest of the world in danger because they flow from and breed intolerance, the world's fastest growth industry. Yet for some reason, we're incredibly reluctant to call to account the intolerant countries who abuse their citizens and instead hide behind silencing concepts like cultural relativism, domestic sovereignty, or root causes. These are concepts that excuse intolerance. Silence in the face of intolerance means intolerance wins. Nous devons être attentifs à ce qui se passe autour de nous et réfléchir sérieusement à ce que nous devons faire pour améliorer les choses. Car, ne nous leurrons pas, nous devons agir because otherwise we risk losing the civilizing sinews that flex the world's muscles after World War II. It's interesting to compare the state of affairs with the legal developments in international trade law. I always get emotional when I think about trade law. In 1994, the WTO was established. After just over 20 years in operation, the WTO and its dispute settlement mechanisms are regarded as legitimate, effective, and are respected. Unlike international human rights law, states comply with international trade law, and if they don't, there's an effective dispute resolution mechanism to respond to the breach. And unlike the UN, the WTO is extremely difficult to join. That means that the global community feels that obtaining membership in a trade organization should be harder than obtaining membership in an organization responsible for saving humanity from inhumanity. I find this dissonance stark and unsettling. Doesn't it raise questions about the effectiveness of the UN as a deliberative body? We have to first acknowledge that many of the UN's agencies have achieved remarkable success in a number of areas: peacekeeping, shelter and relief for refugees, UNICEF's extraordinary efforts on behalf of children, and the World Health Organization's fights against polio, malaria, smallpox, among others. The agencies have raised awareness about violence against women, the environment, and the plight of children. And the fact that much of international law works at all is often due to UN-based agencies. But the UN was the institution the world set up to implement never again. Its historical tutor was the Holocaust. Yet it seems hardly to be an eager pupil. What was never supposed to happen again has, again and again. In a world so often seeming to be spinning out of control, shouldn't we ask the global community to rethink its almost reflexively protective attitude towards this institutional behemoth? Stop making excuses for its seemingly infinite patience for injustice, and insist that it do the job it was set up to do. Which brings me, in conclusion, to why both this international cri de coeur and my earlier Valentine to Canada feel so personal to me. They feel personal because I'm the product of both. My parents had married in Poland on September the 3rd, 1939, the day World War II officially started. They spent most of the war in concentration camps. Their two-year-old son and my father's entire family were killed at Treblinka. They ended up in Stuttgart, Germany after the war, where my father, a lawyer, taught himself English and was appointed by the Americans as a legal counsel for displaced persons in southwest Germany. In 1946, shortly after my parents were liberated, I was born on July the 1st. Honest. Après avoir tenté pendant des années d'entrer au Canada, nous avons finalement obtenu la permission de le faire and landed at Pier 21 on May 30th, 1950, as Jewish refugees. Mes parents étaient bien déterminés à ne pas se laisser abattre par tout ce qu'ils avaient perdu, mais au contraire, à se rebâtir une vie en poursuivant de nouveaux rêves. Within days of arriving in Toronto, my father went to the Law Society to ask what tests he would need to take to become a lawyer, as he had in Stuttgart. None, they said. Non-citizens can't be lawyers. Waiting the 5 years it took in those days to become a citizen was impossible. There was a family to feed. So he became an insurance agent for the next 20 years, happily. The moment I heard that story as a child about my father not being able to be a lawyer was the moment I decided to become one. I was 4, and I had no idea what it meant. But growing up, people told me that girls weren't lawyers. Not so, said my parents. This is Canada. With hard work, anything is possible. My father died a month before I finished law school. and never lived to see his inspiration take flight in the daughter he and my mother raised to fear only injustice, indifference, and cowardice. Or in his two grandsons, both of whom followed in his footsteps and became lawyers. But he knew somehow it would turn all right for the family because he was confident in Canada's generosity. And how right he was. My parents saw Canada as a country that respected their commitment to rebuild a joyful family, respected their right to retain in demonstrable pride the religious identity that had attracted such brutality in Europe, and respected their hopes that life in Canada would provide peace, safety, and fairness. Canada's triumphal triumvirate of opportunity, generosity, and idealism is Canada's best self. It is the Canada that took one generation's European horror story and turned it into another generation's Canadian fairy tale. And the Canada that took a life that started in a displaced persons camp in Germany and nurtured it all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. It could not have happened anywhere else. I feel so lucky and proud to be Canadian. Erwin, thank you for the honor of letting my name be linked publicly with yours and Raoul Wallenberg's, and for being an internal inspiration for how to make sure the moral arc of the universe leans always towards justice. Thank you.
That was a real tour d'horizon, anchored in a literary and historical architecture, I would say, underpinned by a very moving personal memoir, which made it all the more the tour d'horizon that it was. We have now an opportunity for questions, and Justice Abella will respond to them from here. I see a hand up there. Yeah.
Well, we're judges. We don't know what those political conversations are. But sometimes I read the newspaper. It's a very good question because it raises what used to be a serious public concern that we saw mostly in the United States, I would say in the 80s and 90s, but a little bit here, but not so much, and it was this. We don't want judges with any views that's bias. We want judges who will be impartial. And the theory was, if you had views, that you couldn't be impartial, which was a political statement meant, how should I put this, to presumptively dismiss the decisions of judges they weren't going to like. Now, let's parse that. Do you want anyone over the age of 10 not having opinions? So the question is, of course you want judges who have opinions. They should. They're adult. They're educated. They should be knowledgeable in the world. What you want, though, is judges who, notwithstanding what their views are, will be open to what they hear. In other words, there's a difference between an empty mind and an open mind. And sometimes what happens in some countries is that the brain is a cerebral basket and people hear evidence and arguments, and they end up taking the shape of that brain. That's called ideology. An open mind listens, confronts its own views, and says, okay, I understand that it's different. So there isn't a clear line of separation. Politicians do what they do. They pass the laws. They are the people who gave us the charter and said, you tell us whether we're constitutionally compliant in what we do. We're respectful of what government does. We have to be. But if they breach the Constitution, we have a wonderful section called Section 1, which says you have to justify whether this limit is reasonable in a free and democratic society. That's where practical realities, you can call them political, are argued, and then the case either made or not made for a conclusion that the political sphere has justified the limitation that it's imposed on the right. So we don't ignore each other. Politicians, I think, know that there is always a chance that what they decide will come under constitutional scrutiny, and judges know that what they are scrutinizing has come from people who represent a majority, which brings me to my last point. One of the things that was most interesting when I was following what was going on in the United States in the 80s and 90s, when they first started talking about judicial activism, which just means I don't like your decision, because they stopped saying it after Bush v. Gore because it got him a president. But anyway, that's not for the press. Don't you dare. But what was missing from all of that was an understanding of the separation of powers. In this sense, people who run for public office have every 4 or 5 years to go back to the people who elected them to see whether or not those people still want them to remain in office. Majoritarian concerns. Courts are peopled by judges who are there till they're 75 in this country, who are independent so that they can make decisions that don't always accord with what the majority wants, but represent minority positions that are nonetheless constitutionally viable. So, does that make courts unpopular from time to time? Of course. But that's why we have independence, and that's why we have tenure, and that's why we have a duty to follow our conscience and the law, even if it means it's going to be a critical editorial. But we're lucky in this country because the worst that happens is a critical editorial. There are some countries in the world where being independent and saying what you think can cost you your job, can endanger your life. So if we take a long view, an historical view, we'll be judged by history, as Frayn's play shows us, and we just do what we think is right in the moment based on everything we know. But we don't say, oh, the majority wants this, the minority wants this. We weigh it. It's all balancing. But it was a very good question. Fair. But remember this. Courts are, and judges are, passive. Let me just explain our role. We don't put signs outside our courthouse that say, you know, Thursday at 4 would be a good time to bring an environmental case. So we only hear the cases that people bring to us. We're, in that sense, a passive institution. We aren't roving Don Quixote's looking for injustices in the landscape. We decide what is brought to us. Does that mean that there are issues left to be decided by legislatures and eventually the courts? Of course, and that's really what you're saying. But we're on a trajectory, and all I wanted to show is, and I acknowledge that we're not 100% there, but if you're somebody like me who thinks that you can't maybe ever get in one lifetime absolute justice, you have to strive towards the reduction of injustice. And I think what we've done in this lifetime is eliminate a great deal of injustice that had been there when I started. And so, yes, there's more to be done, but we have good legislators whom you elect who listen to all of that and take it very seriously. That's the United Nations. It's a responsibility to protect was a Canadian concept that came in 2005. I think it ran into serious trouble in 2009. I don't know what the status is now, and I'm not going to speak at all about what the leaders of countries do or don't do. But I will tell you that one of the concerns that I have about the UN is exactly that, the inability of R2P to flex sufficient muscles. Things just keep going on and on and on. But what gets into a decision about who to talk to and when to talk to and all of that in the hopes of ameliorating, I'm not going to pass any judgment on that. Well, I think I'm going to give you my opinion in about 3 years when it comes to the court. but until then, I'm very reluctant to weigh in. Yeah. It is, I know, a very hot issue. Students what? Sorry, I didn't hear.
A student who had brown hair.
Oh.
Which brought to my mind the 1929 case of Short against Ball Corporation, enshrined in English law as the epitome of unreasonable exercise of executive power, in which Warrington Lord Justice, giving the example of the red-haired teacher dismissed because she had red hair. This matter made me think about the rule of law, as propounded by the late Lord Bingham. Specifically, his third rule, which says laws of the land should apply equally to all, save to the extent that objective differences justify differentiation, which he exemplified as a pillar of the rule of law by quoting a very poignant observation of Justice Jackson of the Supreme Court of the United States that dates back to 1949 in the case of Railway Express Agency against New York. As Lord Bingham further put it, a state which savagely repressed or persecuted sections of its people could not, in my view, be regarded as observing the rule of law, even if the transport of a persecuted minority to the concentration camp or the compulsory exposure of female children on the mountains like were the subject of detailed laws duly enacted and scrupulously observed. I think that's his fourth sub-rule, which says the law must support adequate protection of fundamental human rights. So my question is, why do we continue to see laws being designed and enacted, sometimes in bad faith, under the veil of unproven security reasons, a legislative shenanigan aimed at minority sections of society, whether nationals or non-nationals, in the hope that the courts might adopt some proportionality to reasonableness, test to serve
This is tying in a bit, I think, with the question that we had right at the beginning, and that is it fair, I guess, is it appropriate to leave to court some of these very difficult social issues where lines are drawn? And I think the answer is that we are both in the justice business, legislators and courts, and we can't say we wish you hadn't passed that law. We can only say we've reviewed your law, we've reviewed your arguments, and we think it's constitutional or we think it's unconstitutional. But your question, I mean, it's a very complicated question, and there are so many important legal points in it. It's something you should... Are you a law student here? Well, I think that sounds like the first paragraph in a very interesting biography one day. But don't think that this is just about courts and legislatures. I have always thought that a third branch in the justice business is the media. And if you feel law school is out of reach or the legislature is out of reach and you have things you want to think about in public, then there's always the media. We have a very strong independent media in this country. So it's not just two players, I see three.
Okay, one last question up there. Yeah.
I'm Sabrina. So my name is Sabrina, and I grew up as a Muslim woman in France. I was born Tunisian. My parents are immigrants. And I have learned that tolerance.
To which, I'm sorry, from tolerance to empathy. Ah, President Obama's famous word. Yes? He said he wanted judges who were empathetic. And then the wrath of certain people came down on him, and I think we didn't hear the word again. First, let me give a mini defense to the word tolerance. I think tolerance, words like tolerance, empathy, compassion, fairness, are the underlying sources of moral law, certainly in the constitutional frame. They're not enforceable norms. Our anti-discrimination laws are enforceable. Our constitutional rights are enforceable. And words such as the adjective you used are important because they say what the big picture is supposed to look like, but they don't give the answer to how it's going to play out in any particular case. But I don't know that I will ever in my lifetime see all of the social problems that people who are different feel will ever be totally solved. I mean, one of the things that I've learned as I've gotten older is that every time we think we've fixed one issue, we see either textures to that issue that require further elaboration or attention, or brand new issues. I mean, it started in the 70s with what do we do to help women who were considered at law. There was one personality when a woman got married, and it was the husband. So we did a lot to fix that, and then we moved the flashlight around, and we saw that we hadn't been properly treating people with disabilities, and then we saw that they were indigenous people who had been so badly treated. But what happened in every one of those cases, which comes back to what you do, much of it came from the groups themselves, from the people who were actually experiencing what they felt was the discrimination, the lack of tolerance. They brought it to public attention, and once it was brought to public attention, they left it to legislatures to pass the necessary laws, and then the courts followed somewhere afterwards. And that's where, again, the media comes in, because the media in the 70s was the place that people learned what injustices people who weren't like them were experiencing. They kind of exposed us to the information we needed to be able to figure out what needed to be fixed next. So there'll always be a next. I think if you're in the social advocacy world, don't worry, business will always be booming. But we address these in the courts one issue at a time, one case at a time. Legislatures do it several constituencies and collegial concerns at a time. The media does it based on its own concerns, and you do it based on your own constituency. But it's not counterpoint. It's supposed to ultimately be harmonious, and because we're making one Canadian song together, and we need all of the parts and all of the pieces, all of the notes. And it'll be a greater song when we have more notes. So. Do you want me to sing them?
We could almost be exposed to yet another quality of Rosie, that is her talents as a musician. Let me, as I listened to the questions and questions which related to issues of tolerance and intolerance and really delved into issues of humanity, I was struck by what the nominator for the award that Justice Abella recently received as the Global Jurist of the Year said. I'm going to just read it to you, and with that I'll close, because I was prompted to it by the questions, because it says something about the qualities of being a judge. And this is what he said. What I said in my nomination that really distinguished Justice Abella from so many other great jurists in Canada, the U.S., and around the world is the way she brings extraordinary human decency to the law. And then went on and concluded. I've never met any judge in my life who understands people better than Justice Abella and the importance of people in the judicial process. I think the human quality she brings to the bench is unsurpassed in my experience. And tonight you saw that human quality at work, anchored in that incredible repository of expertise, experience, and the empathy which is always in expression in her daily life in all her relationships. Thank you for being with us this evening.
Thank you.